All right, thanks for joining us with the Junk Connoisseurs, the podcast with 97% more Neanderthal DNA than most podcasts.
That's a lot of Neanderthal.
So yeah, we're here to talk about some vehicles tonight, or a vehicle, or an engine, or something like that. And yeah, I believe
nobody's picked an engine platform yet.
Yeah, and that's fine. We've been doing
kind of did with the Civic. You picked the Civic, and then specifically just the engine that's in some Civics now.
Yeah. The SHO is kind of the same way, because that was the main part of why that was cool.
Kind
of
did it with the Wankel and the RX-7.
I did. But
yeah, and we could do that. That's fine, too. I always thought that might be, you know, a particularly interesting engine platform or something that warrants a full discussion. Sure, why not?
Somebody else dive on the Chevy 350 grenade, so I'm not tempted, since I have a history of going way too broad.
What, Iron Duke isn't your first choice?
Let's see. It does have some really fiery history, so maybe.
True.
Yeah. Spicy.
Well, I believe that Alan is it tonight as far as picking a topic. So, Alan, have you prepared a topic for us tonight?
In fact, I have.
Nice. All right. I was listening to an old episode on the way up here. Not an old episode, the latest episode on the way up here. And I do that mostly so that I think it's like, if we don't listen to our own episodes, it's like not voting for ourselves in an election, right? We got to actually listen to our own.
Yeah, well, no, I do that.
I've heard every one of these. Yes. I've heard every one of these episodes about 38 times in the editing process.
Just trying to pump up our download numbers.
Yep. Well, they're downloaded anyway. I don't know how that algorithm works for sure, but I figure when we subscribe, it downloads them. I assume it helps to listen to them, so I don't know.
I think we just got to pay Spotify for, you know, it's payola, but whatever. Huh. It's like a nickel a stream.
Mm.
Well, that'll be like $6 for us.
Woo-hoo. Very generous.
I mean, across the entirety of the year plus we've been doing this.
There you go.
It's jacket money. Okay, so this vehicle, in keeping with certain trends, like Motor Trend, this was the Motor Trend car of the year.
All right. So I think that rules out the Humvee.
It does rule out the Humvee.
Okay. Yeah.
It was never really available for that particular publication.
That came out in the most recent episode that went live. That was one we're like, ooh, that'd be a good one to talk about in the future. Right. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
It's on my list.
What are the odds we're talking about it tonight? No. All right. So it was a Zero. Motor Trend car of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So not truck of the year.
No.
Was it Motor Trend import car of the year?
It was not.
Okay. I don't know that means it wasn't an import, but it doesn't mean that it is an import.
I think at some point they sort of removed that portion of the list, because it was definitely the domestic list and then the...
Yeah, they recombined it at one point.
Oh, yeah. What is Motor Trend? Is it like a podcast or a fax service?
Oh, sit on my knee, my son, and let me tell you a tale of print journalism. I say that. I just subscribed to Car and Driver, like the print magazine Car and Driver for my office today.
Nice.
Like, okay, this makes me feel like a dinosaur.
Yeah. All right. So Motor Trend Car of the Year at some point.
Mm-hmm. Had a run of 13 model years.
13 model years.
Only about 6 of which were good.
Hmm.
Okie dokie.
Was this vehicle available both carbureted and fuel injected?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Which of those two was it?
Carburetors forever.
Ah.
Okay. I would have guessed the other. I would have guessed it was fuel injected, but I'm just trying to narrow it down to a time frame. And, if it was 80s, it would have been both.
This vehicle goes 3 for 3 on the Alex Trifecta. Well,
available is 2 for $3. Real men would get it 3 for $3.
Right.
And Alex will still never buy one.
Oh, wow. That doesn't surprise
me. Even if he could afford it, his eye would slide right off of it.
Oh. So it's a beige mobile.
No, not really.
Yeah.
Is it just too valuable?
No.
It is now.
Well, okay. Yeah.
But even if you had the money, you'd be like, I don't know what that is.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Oh.
But it's a domestic.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Or you'd know what it is, and you'd be like, eh.
So it is probably a Chrysler product.
He gets it.
There we go.
1 for $3 on the Triangle of Sadness, because this was sort of a genre-defining car, and Chrysler did it first.
Okay.
Never had an Iron Duke. Lotus not involved.
Yeah.
In keeping with other trends, it is named after a bird.
Oh.
Alex has it.
I think so.
We are in the area where I am not.
I'm gonna drag Jordan along by the nose a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's see here. 3 body styles.
Coupe, sedan, 2-door hard. Oh, convertible.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They did those weird, like, this one's a notchback and this one's a the time period everyone
They did. This was a 2-door coupe, a 2-door sedan, basically a 2-door sedan, a 2-door hardtop, or a convertible. And later on, it was only available as a 2-door sedan.
Okay.
So fixed B pillar.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of a big deal in NASCAR, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you made Roadrunner noises earlier, so I don't recall what that is based on. Because is that a standalone car or was it a model of a specific car? We are way outside my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Clearly. It was, in fact, the Plymouth Roadrunner.
Yeah.
Which was a standalone model.
Well, okay. So the reason I say that is I wasn't certain if it was a situation where it was a package for something else.
Fair enough. This is not a Grand National situation,
right? Yeah,
the Roadrunner was its own deal.
It was its own deal.
Okay. I didn't know that either, and I can't keep straight.
What are its siblings?
So it was developed off the base car was the Plymouth Belvedere,
okay,
which was just the Chrysler product at the time. So, ready for the history lesson?
Yeah,
sure. All right.
So, 1967, Plymouth got on the intermediate muscle car train with the GTX, which was basically a fancy B-body was the platform, mm-hmm. and it was a Lugzo muscle car, 2-door, B-body Chrysler. It was expensive. It was luxurious by 60s domestic standards, and it was fast, but it was expensive. Punched right along with the GTO, which was not particularly cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, you're getting into stuff like the Chevelle SS at that time, which these were upmarket versions of intermediate cars, all which had big engines, mm-hmm. you know, 400 plus cubic inches. And Plymouth thought that there was a niche that everybody was missing with an economy muscle car. So big car, big engine, no frills.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they took their 2-door at the first year in 1968 was just a 2-door sedan was all that was available. They put in a 383 cubic inch big block engine, took their 325 horse moderately hot version of that they had that they put in the GTX and a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They gave it a special cam that was not available with air conditioning because it did not produce enough vacuum at idle to run the air conditioner. A 4-speed was the base motor, bench seat, 335 horsepower. They paid Warner Brothers $50 for every car they've sold in order to use the Roadrunner's likeness and to put a horn in it that was painted bright purple and would go meep, meep whenever you would bump the horn button. Let's see here. There were some options. You could, if you were willing to spend an extra $714, you could get a Hemi, the Chrysler 426 Hemi, which at the time was, let's say, arguably top dog amongst available street engines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rated from the factory at 425 horsepower and I think 490 pound-feet of torque.
What year was this again?
68.
68, okay. Mm-hmm,
was the first year. So they thought they would have a hit. They thought they were cautiously optimistic. It was priced at $29.45. Today, that would be $24,000.
And you could get the Hemi version for $36,000.
Today, that would be $30,000.
Right.
So if
you could get a 425 horse Hemi Roadrunner for 30 grand.
Uh-huh. So let's compare this now to modern muscle cars, mm-hmm. such as they are, mm-hmm. which all, if you're going to V8, you're starting at about 36, 37, I think, and yeah, going I don't know from where there.
The Mustang starts.
I think you can get a V8 Mustang for under 40, if only just.
Right. Where's the Charger at?
Charger with a V8 starts about 43. It's gone. They're done making it.
Yeah.
Camaro, I think, is right at 40 for a V8.
I think those are out, too.
They might be dead. I don't know. I think they they're dying or dead.
Yeah, 24 maybe was the last year, but I thought 23 was. Maybe that was the Canadian market was 23. Anyway, yeah, so, it's the Mustang.
The base model was stripped. Bench seat, no console, rubber floor mat, no tack. Like, they literally took their economy car and said, here you go. We're going to put the biggest, well, it's not the biggest engine we've got, a much bigger engine than you can get for this price in anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And they thought they hoped they would sell 15,000. They sold 40,000.
they were onto something. Yeah.
Yeah. The road test of the original 383 automatic Roadrunner in 68 was 15 flat at 93 miles an hour on 1968 tires, which is not all that fast, but it's still the way I see it.
24 grand. It's pretty
24
fast.
Grand. And that's a 3,650 pound car. These are not light.
Wow. I was not expecting that much chunk.
Yeah. They're chonky. They're big. Like they were a mid-sized car by 1960s American standards, which makes them like a
17 feet long.
Yeah, like a yacht today. Yeah.
They were
like
a little bigger than the GM offerings of the time, right? The GTOs and the Chevelles. It
would be the same class, but they might have 6 inches. Yeah.
Okay. I just feel like they always look just a little
same
bigger.
Same midsize, you know. Definitely smaller than an Impala or like a Catalina, but
Yeah.
They're big.
Yep. Fairlane would be in that area.
Fairlane would be the Ford equivalent.
Yeah, because it wasn't the Torino by that point.
This was nothing new. Putting a big engine in a midsize car like this had been a thing for a long time. And Pontiac really hit it big in 64 mm-hmm. with the GTO.
Yeah.
But the GTO was expensive. And you could option a Roadrunner up to be expensive, or you could go buy a GTX. Right. But you couldn't option down a GTO mm-hmm. to the point that you could buy one for, you know, the equivalent of 24 grand today.
Right.
So in 1969, it's Motor Trend's Car of the Year. They added a convertible. Hmm. They made about 2,000 of those that year. They made 80,000 1969 Roadrunners.
Wow.
They continued to sell the 383 and the Hemi. They also added the 446 barrel.
Okay, so the two original engines continued, mm-hmm. and then
and,
the 440.
And they kind of added a center, like a bridge between them with the 446.
Right.
In the Plymouth, it's the 446 barrel. Everybody refers to it as the 446 pack, which is technically just Dodge marketing. Mm-hmm. But I think in 69, the Dodge got their own too because they were jealous. So Dodge got the Super B, which was effectively maybe a couple $100 more expensive and just a little less Spartan. Mm-hmm. But you know, Plymouth being the value brand, they Dodge got jealous and said, we want one too. Mm-hmm. So, okay, here you go.
Well, I had a thought and we should come back to this later, but to compare the Chevy SS to the Charger.
It's a good idea. We'll discuss
later.
So the 69 Roadrunner, 31,000 coupes, 45,000 hardtops, about 2,000 convertibles. The 446 pack was available, which was 390 horsepower and 490 pound-feet of torque. If you ordered the 446 pack, you got a Dana 60 with 4 10-to-1 gears and steel wheels, and that was it.
You need that.
They were a missile. They only made about 800 of the 446 okay. pack. Road test from period. They road tested a Hemi 4-speed 69 Roadrunner. Anyone care to guess?
On
1969 tires?
Quarter mile time?
Quarter mile time.
Mid to low 13s, but probably trapping like 105 or higher.
13.5 at 106.
Woo!
Nice.
Zero That's to pretty 60, good for somebody who doesn't know anything about drag racing. 0 to 60
5 flat.
Yeah.
On 1969 bias plies with no weight in the back. They're fast.
Yeah, you put modern rubber on that. It's a 4-second, a mid to low 4-second 60. Assuming you can get the transmission to be happy enough to shift. I guess it only has the one shift, or maybe not even that.
It was a 4-speed, you said.
Yeah, that was a 4-speed. So it's
410s. It's probably got
one. Well, that may not have had four. That probably had 410s for that fast. So yeah, you'd probably shift into third towards the end of that run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I would think.
Well, I meant 60. So you probably have a 1-2 shift in there. But definitely third gear on a quarter mile run.
Other fun options in 69, they got cabin actuated, the air grabber hood, which basically took the one nod to style that the original 68 Roadrunner got was a hood with two fake vents on either side with a call out that said either 383 or 426 on it. In 68, you could get an option where you could actually, it had like a choke cable labeled carb air on the dash and you could like pull it and the vents would open and there was a fiberglass box underneath that you could actually draw cold air into the engine.
Nice.
No discernible performance increase, but pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a cool gadget. It probably sold like hotcakes.
Well, and realistically, very few things make me more cranky than factory optioned fake hood scoops.
Yeah, those are
it's like just why.
Yeah.
Just because car guys will buy them. Okay.
Well, you maybe don't like not. Aftermarket functional hood scoops either. You're like flat hoods or nothing.
I like hood. Flat hood. Flat hooder. Yeah. You caught me. A cowl is not a hood scoop. we don't need to get into
induction
that.
Hood. Yeah. Not, okay.
So 1970, they're still on the same basic styling, which is now getting a little dated. Got a new grill, standard disc brakes up front, which are nice too. When you've got a car this fast, it's nice to be able to haul it down from speed.
Yeah, especially on 1970 bias ply tires. Yeah, and more than once.
And you could get suspension that would make these handle okay for a muscle car, but the stock suspension was not a handler. It was a straight line, look good, go fast, make cool noises. That was it.
America.
It got a new air grabber, which was kind of cool because it was now a vacuum operated door in the middle of the hood that you'd pull the carb air cable and this little basically like a 10 inches wide by 2 foot panel would just rise up and it says air grabber on the side with this like shark mouth.
See,
it's pretty neat.
That's cool as hell. Like that. I don't care if it doesn't do anything other than the fact that it does something. It's not just like a sticker,
Chrysler giveth, but Chrysler also taketh away.
Oh.
The base transmission in 1970 is now a 3-speed, still on the floor.
Yeah.
They didn't sell very many of them. It was almost like a delete option where it was like, no, I'll pay extra for more gears. Still options on the engines, 383, 446 pack or Hemi, no real discernible change in output on any of those. Sales fell from 80,000 to 40,000, partially because Chrysler had been looking over GM's shoulder and decided, you know what we need to do is compete with ourselves. When they released another economy muscle car, the Duster 340, which, although only a small block, was still very fast, still very cheap, and, still very stylish because the design was kind of, not much else out there in the economy market that looked that good.
Well, and the Duster's probably several hundred pounds lighter.
About 600 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
And it's a lot smaller.
It's got to handle better.
Marginally. the base model of any of these didn't handle that well. They were all undersprung, softly sprung.
Yeah.
We're talking Chrysler's state of the art. Everything's a unibody. Everything up front is unequal length control arms with longitudinal torsion bars for springs.
Okay.
Which work pretty well, actually. Yeah. The geometry's not bad, but they're they make it a real pain in the butt to do anything in terms of changing your exhaust around, because not only do you have like a steering shaft running forward to the steering box in the engine bay, you've also got these two thick steel springs coming back that, that anchor by the transmission that you can't move.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, we'll talk about that later.
Gotcha.
So they built about 40,000 Roadrunners in 1970. Of those 40,000, they made 1,935 Plymouth Superbirds, which are the baddest ass of the Roadrunners. So we take a stock Roadrunner.
Well, this is the you'll get to this. I'm
this
sure.
is the aero car.
This is the one that I'm thinking of.
This is the one you're thinking of. So in 1969, Dodge had the B-body was not a very clean car aerodynamically. It looked good, but it did not. It cut a wide swath through the air, as did most things in the 60s.
Seven and a half feet wide.
Wasn't a big deal out on the highway.
It wasn't a big deal on the highway, but at this point, the biggest pissing match between the domestic car makers was NASCAR.
Yes.
And they were knocking on the door of 200 miles an hour, which again, 1970s tires. by comparison, modern NASCAR cars run about 200 miles an hour. They haven't really gotten faster. So they had the engine to shove it through the air that fast. And in 68, I think Ford had built the Cyclone spoiler and the Torino Talladega, which had flush grills. And I think they had a flush back window too, instead of kind of the inset back window that everything had.
Right.
And those were immediately like 5 or 10 miles an hour faster on the super speedways, like Talladega. Than anything else, just because they were cleaner aerodynamically. They weren't more powerful.
Slide through the air easier.
So in 69, Dodge said, okay, well, anything you can do, we can do better. So they built the Charger Daytona, which was a B-body Charger with a flush backlight, an 18-inch long schnoz with pop-up headlights in place of the flush mount grille that they had originally had on the Charger 500. And a rear spoiler that stood about 3 feet off the trunk lid. It was almost 6 feet tall. It was big enough that it bolted to the fenders and the trunk lid could open under it.
A Charger trunk is not a short thing.
No, this is, and it, like if you've never seen one, go look it up.
Yeah.
They're
fantastic.
Somewhat unsurprisingly, they had to build these to homologate them for NASCAR. They had to be a production car. Dodge couldn't sell them because as cool as they look now, nobody wanted to drive one to the grocery store.
It was kind of gaudy, wasn't it?
You just immediately look like Joe Dirt everywhere you go.
This is Joe Dirt's car.
I know.
So in 1970, Dodge built about 1,500 or 2,000 of the Charger Daytona. Sorry, 69, 1,500, 2,000 of the Daytona. And in 70, they shifted to Plymouth. And Plymouth built the Superbird, which was very, very, very similar, not identical. They actually rummaged in the parts bin. They used Coronet front fenders because they were a little cleaner aerodynamically. They used a hood off of I can't remember. But it turns out the biggest thing that nobody really thought about that actually did it for the Superbird was they had these reversed scoops on top of the front fenders, on top of the front wheels, and they were cut out. And basically, it let dirty air from under the fender well out and in the engine bay out over the top of the car. And the internal testing at Chrysler said if they did nothing other than unblock those scoops, there was a 4 mile an hour difference on the top end.
Wow.
And the car was way more controllable, way more pleasant to drive at 200 miles an hour.
Would be important.
These were the first cars to break 200 miles an hour. Wow. In 70, they broke 200 miles an hour at, I think it was at Talladega, which was a relatively new track at the time. So they made 1,935 of them. They were available with the 440 Magnum, the 440 six-pack, or the Hemi. They built about 1,000 440 Magnum, 700 with the six-pack, and about 130 with the Hemi. And then, because Bill France doesn't know how to have fun, he immediately came in and said, okay, guys, we're driving too fast, so if you want to have an aero car, we're going to limit you to 305 cubic inches. And immediately everybody's like, ah, screw it. Fine, Bill. We'll just drive our regular cars and we'll only go 190, which is what happened.
Yeah.
Did Dodge even have anything in the 5-ish liter arena?
We're getting there.
Okay, gosh.
They did, actually. What they had with the in Trans Am Racing, which had the 5-liter limit, they took a 340, which is a small block, and I think they destroked it to like 303 cubic inches.
Okay, because I knew that the 340 obviously existed. It was just, I thought that was on the small end of the displacement offerings.
No, they had the small block Dodges started at 273.
Okay.
And if I want to say that the Trans Am motor was a 273 crank and a 340 block.
Okay.
Because the 340 was a big, the 318 was square and the 340 was over square.
Mm-hmm.
The 273 was under square, but not by a lot. So, anyway,
have we discussed what over under square?
We can, for those of you who don't know what that means,
take a small break for that.
So the way you describe the displacement, this is going to turn into describing a carburetor. I know how this is going to end.
It's way less complicated than that.
It is. So essentially, in order to describe the displacement, which is how you measure the size of an engine, you take the piston bore, which is the diameter of the cylinder, and the stroke, which is essentially the throw of the crankshaft. It's how far the crankshaft moves.
How far the piston travels.
How far the piston travels from top to bottom. Yeah. And you multiply those things. A square engine is considered to have bore and stroke being equal. Under square engines have a longer stroke than they do a bore, and they are generally lower revving, torquier on the bottom end, but don't like to spin very fast. Mm-hmm. Over square engines make a lot of power up top, but all other things considered are relatively lifeless down low.
Mm-hmm.
So most performance engines tend to be square or over square.
Yeah.
Tend to. There are always exceptions. Okay.
Yeah.
So
see, that wasn't carburetor levels of insanity.
Yeah, that wasn't so bad.
Carburetor?
No, I agree. That's a pretty good description of it.
Metal box that squirts fuel and goes bang.
So in 71, they had the first redesign. They went to the fuselage look that the full-size Chryslers had gone to the year before. Killed off the convertible, killed off the hardtop. Everything was just a coupe. Underneath, very similar. These are my favorite body style of these cars. These are probably the 71 and 72 Roadrunner are probably my favorite muscle car. They are good looking. Sadly, they are now based on the Satellite. They killed the Belvedere off, and the Satellite, which had been the mid-range model, is now the base model. The Satellite is now the basis for the Roadrunner. Same size, roughly the same weight, much curvier, like much less squared off body.
Right.
The small block is now the new base engine. So it's the first time you get a small block V8 in the Roadrunner. It is the 340. It does make 275 horsepower, according to the stat sheet. It actually dynos at about 265 at the wheels. They run really, really well. And Chrysler has been accused of underrating them for insurance purposes.
I mean, hasn't all of the big three been accused of that at one point in the late 60s and 70s?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
This is one of the more widespread examples of this, though. And this was a production engine. This wasn't like the Boss 429 or the ZL1.
Yeah.
This was...
I think the other ones maybe were a little more... that was more prevalent in their specialty models.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just the 340,
right.
Like mid-range economy sports thing.
The 383 was still a lot more popular. It was down to 300 horsepower. We're starting to feel the squeeze on emissions from 335, but still very powerful. You could still get the Hemi in the 446 pack. They were way less common. They'd never been common, but now they are, I think, special order only from the dealer. And they made 14,000. So we're down. 2 years ago, they sold 80,000. This year, there's 14,000.
Yeah.
It's getting to the point where they're
They're dwindling.
Insurance was, you know, the whole idea with the Roadrunner was to put a muscle car in the common young man's garage. Yeah. The guy who's working in McDonald's can afford to haul ass. Well, he can still afford to haul ass, but he can't afford to insure it.
Because he's in the demographic that makes, that has poor judgment.
Yeah. Yeah.
makes poor choices while driving.
The hits keep coming in 1972. Cosmetically very similar, still great looking. Emissions are starting to take in its toll. The 340 is now down to 240 horsepower and gets a cast crank instead of the forged bottom end it has. The 400 is now the optional big block, which the 400, I don't know if there's a Chevy or Ford equivalent here, but so amongst Mopar guys, the 400 is regarded as a smog era motor, although it is, if because it was only built during the smog era.
Right.
But it's essentially a bored out 383. Mm-hmm. It has a great rod ratio. It's over square. And a cam and induction and headers will wake this thing up. And a little bit of compression. By this point, we're getting into the malaise era. And we're down to like 8.5, 9 to 1 compression.
Right.
But the 400 is still a popular something that people buy. Mm-hmm. They folded the GTX into the Roadrunner model line. It's now the top of the line Roadrunner, and it's only available with a 440. They made 7,000 Roadrunners total, so half the year before. 1973, they uglified it, gave it a more formal roofline and grill. The base motor is now not only a small block, but a two-barrel carburetor small block. It is a 318 two-barrel at a whopping 170 horsepower.
Oh, yeah.
The 340 is still available. The 400 is still available. And the 400 still makes 280 horse. By this point, the writing is on the wall, though. The 440 is still available in the GTX. Autos are outselling 4-speeds by 5 to 1.
Wow.
They made a total of 7,000. So every year, we're halving what the last year sold.
Right.
So I need to take just a tiny step back.
Go for it.
73 or 74, they changed the roof line.
73.
You called that a more formal roof line. Did they like paint a tuxedo on it? I'm confused what that term means.
Can we go off the record for a second so I can slap him? They squared it off.
Okay.
They took the much more fluid, like fastback-esque look.
Yeah.
And gave it like, you know, like they made basically like an MGB GT. Like they took that squared off angle roof line and put it on there, and they kind of ruined. It was still okay.
Yeah,
but they kind of blew what had been a great looking car.
They made it frumpy.
Yeah,
they frumpified it.
Formal is frumpy. Got it.
74 was very similar to 73. They had the 318 two barrel, which they sold about 6,000 of. The 340 was dead, and it got the 360, which, yes, it's bigger, but it did not run quite the same way as the 340 did. It wasn't a revver. We're getting into more like the personal luxury stuff now. They weren't fast. They weren't slow, but they weren't great.
Well, you can't have performance be your selling point in malaise period. So
we're not quite to malaise yet with 74, but the writing's on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
In 75, they restyled it, and it's now based off the Fury, which had been a full-size car and is now a compact car. Not compact, mid-size. Mm-hmm. It's a nameplate that's on a mid-size car. And it was absolutely mechanically – the suspension and running gear is identical to what was in 1968,
okay,
except it had discs. You could get a 318, a 360, a 400, and a 440 was technically not available, but hypothetically. I will say I've never seen one of these. They exist, but we are now squarely in the malaise era, and this is not a pretty car by muscle car standards. It's still kind of neat. It's cool. It's old, but it's not great.
Yeah.
In 76, the Roadrunner becomes an option package on the Velari. And y'all really want to talk about it? We can, but I don't particularly want to discuss it.
Yeah, considering you said 13 years and 6 of them were good.
Yeah, so. Basically. Yeah. 68 to 72, that was 73.
Yeah. Years. Yeah.
Those were the years.
It was really on a different platform by then, and it was just an option package.
And the Velari was no longer – it was a compact car. Mm-hmm. It was what was developed to replace the Dart Duster Valiant and Dart Sport. And kind of neat in some ways. They moved the torsion bars are now L-shaped, which means they all fit compactly onto the subframe, which means hot rodders 30 years later love these because you can get independent suspension and just like pull it out and slap it under something. And they work really well under fat fender hot rods.
The Dodge Mustang II equivalent.
Sort of, yeah. They're wider, which doesn't work great for like 30s hot rods, but you know, your 40s stuff, which got wider, doesn't work well with a Pinto or a Mustang too. So this fits nicely under there.
Yeah.
The Big Block is dead by 76.
Long live the Big Block.
Yeah. Well, the Big Block is not dead. The Big Block still exists, in our hearts and in the Little Red Express.
Yes.
And police cars.
And motorhomes.
Yes. Where most big blocks come from today.
Yep.
You get a 318 two barrel or a 364 barrel. Hypothetically, I don't think I've ever seen a 364 barrel Roadrunner. My dad did buy a parts car Roadrunner Velare that had a 440 just hacked into it. Mm-hmm. He got it running and took it out on the road once and it was terrifying. In 1979, the Slant 6 becomes the standard engine for the Roadrunner package, and we're done here. And then the name dies with the Velare in 1980, possibly mercifully. Yeah. The Coyote finally got it. So, yeah, there's your history lesson.
Junk Connoisseurs is sponsored in part by Food Enough. Food Enough is the meal kit company for folks who aren't too picky and really just need to eat, but can't be bothered to shop or plan meals in advance. Other meal kit companies employ chefs to curate menus of gourmet food. They send them to you, and you have to spend a bunch of time cooking. All this just to make a hungry feeling go away? At Food Enough, we realize not everyone wants that. Instead of chefs, we have a network of slackers in Crocs and bathrobes that come up with basic combinations of highly processed, food-like ingredients that you can order and eat when starvation is looming. So try out Food Enough today. Food Enough, for when gas station food will do, but you don't feel like driving all the way to the gas station.
These cars have like special, they mean a lot to me. My dad had one before I was born and has it again in the form of a unibody and approximately six or seven disassembled 1960s Chryslers stored in the barn.
He's got enough parts to build most of one, right?
He's got enough parts to build one and most of another.
Okay.
Honestly. Yeah, yeah. Well, like if we found another unibody, he hasn't moved on that project in a long time and someday maybe I will, but I don't know. Yeah. But they're neat. They are, they're one of those nameplates that's really fun, I think.
I looked it up. I agree. The 71, 72 is a really sharp looking
car. They're good looking cars.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all, none of them were ugly. The Velares were, but yeah.
As we just discussed, those don't count anyways.
Yeah, not really.
Well, they were always a pretty iconic thing when you'd see at a show or a cruise night or something like that. That's the only way I've ever seen these. You don't see, I shouldn't say you don't see ratty ones driving around, but you said they couldn't get people to buy the Super Bees and the Super Birds.
The Super Bird and the Charger Daytona, the wing cars.
The wing cars, the aero cars. They couldn't get people to buy them. And those ones, I think, pretty quickly went to ridiculous
money. Those have always been high money.
Yeah.
Well, when there's only 35-ish hundred.
Yeah.
And some of them got immediately wrecked because they're muscle cars, of course they did.
Some of them got immediately wrecked. Some of them got sold at a huge discount 3 years later because they finally wanted them off the lot. Supposedly, some of them got converted back to regular Roadrunners and Chargers by the dealer because they couldn't sell this giant, gaudy-ass NASCAR car, which, how'd you like to be that guy?
Yeah.
And I get these confused, the Super B and the Super Bird and the Roadrunner, and I can't keep – and that's why I was saying earlier that Alex won't even know what this is and wouldn't buy one even if he could afford it. And it's because I don't know what they are. I can't keep track of what's what with – Dodge, Chrysler, Plymouth stuff from that era. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I have a hard time remembering what's what.
But he can tell a Camaro from a Firebird.
Yeah. Yeah, I can do
that's
that.
That's my point.
Is that an apples and apples comparison? Because if it is, I'll own it.
Pretty much.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they're the same platform. I mean, there are enough – so mixing up like a Belvedere and a Satellite – That's easy. That's the same as like, that's a Biscayne and that's a Bel Air. And who knows? Fucking nobody. Because they're the same, except for the,
yeah, you know, it's the same car with different chrome.
Right.
Or lack of chrome.
Yeah.
Or,
you know, that's the same idea. But the 68 Roadrunner looked like a satellite. The 69 Roadrunner looked like a satellite a Super B. The 70 Super B is kind of neat because it got one of the weirdest front end treatments you'll ever see. It got the period road test I read described it as two Edsel grills rotated 90 degrees. it's wild looking with like headlights in the grill, and it's just two giant like oblong schnozzes.
And so maybe that's kind of what it is they did a good enough job differentiating the same car in badge engineering this thing. They went beyond badge engineering and they actually made enough visual changes.
Now,
and I never really saw that many of them. Or
I can't tell a Superbird from a Daytona.
Yeah.
If they're painted without the stripes, they all had a stripe package. The Superbird has a 2 foot tall Roadrunner on the side of the spoiler.
Yeah.
And the Daytona has a skunk stripe, or sorry, a tail like Bumblebee stripe.
Uh-huh.
But there are subtle differences between the two of them.
Right.
Well, as you said, the entire front end is different, apparently, even though looking at a photo,
they look the same.
They look real close.
But there are enough differences between them. And apparently that was partially at the insistence of R&D at the NASCAR teams. We're like, hey, if you make some subtle reshaping to the front end here, we might pick up a couple more miles an hour on the top end.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think there was a guy who came to the Centralia Auto Show every year for like 10 years who had a blue Roadrunner Super B, right? Yeah, Super B.
Superbird. Big wing?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Wing. Yeah, and it had four mirrors that were the length of the car, and you know, he'd have I think at one point he had a ramp he brought, and he'd bring the ramp and it would raise up the side.
Car show guys,
I've seen this car.
Yeah. And, it's real nice. It's probably worth a couple hundred grand, if not more, if it's real. But like, that's the only one I've ever seen.
They are basically, they're all restored now because there were enough of them that all the barn finds have been found, snapped up, and fixed. And yeah, I think you're kind of looking at $100K to start for a wing car. You can build your own. And actually, there is a guy I talked to he's in Ashland, who built one out of a Charger here that I saw that is really pretty. It's turquoise color. But yeah, that's you're more likely. It's one of those you're more likely like. You remember when we were at the Cars and Coffee and Brian was like, hey, is that a real Cobra? And we're like, no, buddy, that's fiberglass. But it's the same thing. If you see one in the wild, it is probably a clone.
Right.
Just because nobody drives museums. The expensive ones.
They went nuts value-wise. They're just
– yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason I'm not familiar with them and can't tell them apart is because you never really saw that many in my lifetime.
The wing cars, yeah.
Any of them. Well,
Roadrunners you see. There's a gold one who comes to Cars and Coffee like every time we're there.
I don't think so.
Because I've talked to him repeatedly.
I don't think so. Yeah. I've never seen that.
See, his eyes just – like there's just a 17-foot long hole in reality whenever there's a Chrysler around Alex. He's just like, oh, whoa, I tripped over nothing.
I was trying to get over there to look at that Camaro.
Did you see that sweet third-gen IROC?
Hey, man, those are apparently popular for reasons I don't understand, but...
The original owners are all out of prison and have a little bit of money now.
Wow.
So what's it cost now? We talked about how cheap they were originally.
Yeah.
They're not cheap, no-mo.
No, I'm sure they're not. They're
So what's a... Yeah. Yeah. A driving... like a driver 68 four-speed 383. So like the basic... This is, I went in with my $24,000 and put it on the table and walked out with the cheapest car.
Ironically, it's worth about $24,000 now. In driver grade, no options.
Yeah.
Really? Actually, with the 4-speed, they're about 10-15% more expensive. So figure pushing 30-ish. Yeah. But that's number four condition in Hagerty. So that's like, you know, nice driver, what we would be looking for.
On par with GM pony car offerings, a little more expensive than Ford.
Similar, if anything, a little more expensive. For some reason, Mopar's values are higher. Yeah. For the analogous car all the way around,
well,
it seems like you'll give about 20% more for something with a Pentastar on it. And I don't know why.
But quantity? Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Because they generally sold fewer models than the other two.
I mean.
And that's why the Mustang's probably the cheapest, is because I suspect it sold sold the other two by a fair percentage.
I'd say you're probably right.
Yeah. You know?
And this is not a Mustang class. This is
no, it's bigger.
This would be your Fairlane or your Comet, I guess.
Ford didn't make a ton of this was not a market that Ford was really getting into.
Not by the time the Mustang was out. I mean, in the early 60s they had some hot Fairlanes, had some really hot Fairlanes, but they were they kind of abandoned the mid-size performance market it was Pontiac and Plymouth were the ones who were really killing it. And then the later 60s, the Chevelle really kind of caught up too. I mean, there were, they kind of found their own. Mm-hmm.
The first few years of the Torino, I think those were targeted, but the Fairlane, it was kind of
dowdy.
Yeah. I was going to say frumpy. That's not the right word. I think they're good looking cars, they're formal.
Yeah.
They weren't hot rods.
Right.
Yeah.
And they hadn't been since 63 or 4, whenever you could get a 4.0 whatever.
Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
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 But that was the
seven only of one those. They had.
Yeah. 4.0 whatever.
Well, 427 single red cam.
Some kind of big ass Ford engine. I don't know which family. We've been over
insane
this.
Insane amounts of power. Anyway.
Yeah.
If you want a Hemi Roadrunner.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Well, I mean, you know.
Yeah, you do.
As an investment vehicle, maybe, but not as something I would want to, like, do anything.
Basically, you double a 383 runner's price.
Oh, so you could get into one for 60?
If you could find a number four Hemi Roadrunner, it's about 65. They don't really exist. They've all been restored.
I
didn't think you could touch any of these things for under 100 grand. That would have just been my first
guess. And again, this is Hagerty. I feel like, any Hemi car, especially an original Hemi car, is going to be – they just didn't make very many of them.
Yeah.
I mean, they made 80,000 Roadrunners in 69, and they made, you know, one in 40 was a Hemi.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of those got crushed for their drivetrain to get stuffed into various other things
At one point, they probably weren't crushed. But, this was the cheap way to get a Hemi.
Yeah.
And it would get yanked and put in a, you know, an E-body or something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are – again, like most most muscle cars, if you want one economically, it's probably easiest to build a clone.
Yeah.
Because if you can find a two-door Belvedere or Satellite, you can build a Roadrunner real easily. And without the nameplate, you know, a driving Satellite or Belvedere is probably a $15,000 car in decent shape, you know?
I've got a plan for a clone that we can build on the cheap. And this is going to be big. We're going to get like a four-door Plymouth Horizon from the 80s and put the horn on it that says meep, meep, and a cartoon Roadrunner on the side. I think that'll be big. I think we could build our own clone.
We should go get spoilers off of the cast-off bin from the 90s and 2000s JDM trends, because that's real super beat. Super
Alan's style. Not with us here. He doesn't agree that this is a fantastic idea. No. The decline of the Roadrunner into worse and worse cars, and it skipped the late 70s, but we get into the 80s, or I guess it got to the late 70s. We get into the 80s, and it would have been
a Horizon. Let's change the framing. This is a Lemons car.
I'm thinking
what he's describing is a Lemons.
It really
car.
Is. That's I could
definitely see like building out of a Velari, or you know, because that was the last Murata. Maybe there weren't like you know build a Superbird out of an early '80s. Chrysler two door, of which they made a few, but yeah, that I could get.
By. I was joking. I think what I was really thinking of was the Omni.
Yeah.
That's what I should have said. I don't even know 80s.
They built a badass Omni. So if you're going to build a clone, you paint it black.
You'd build a GLH. Yeah. I know. But no, I was going a different direction with that. You're right, though. That's one of those, you go build a clone and you have just as much fun and it might not have the same value.
I do remember one of the, at the challenge, probably 15 years ago, at the grassroots challenge, somebody built a car they called the Super Turd. And it was a, they had like a 94 Civic that they painted petty blue with a giant wing.
Yep.
And I think they might have either won or like, you know, finished in the money. It was quality homage.
Yeah.
So what I pulled up is a 1981 Plymouth Sapporo.
Sapporo.
So, mm-hmm. Okay. It is a Mitsubishi, but it is rear wheel drive, which is better than like everything that you're describing from the 80s.
Yeah, but where do you find one of those? We did see one recently,
didn't we? The
Osho. Yeah. I remember, like, what the hell this? When in one of our goading sessions, we're like, Alan, go buy this.
No, it's been sitting there for a long time.
That's another one of those captive imports. For $400, that would be fun to buy and, like,
stuff. If it
has
a title, if it has a title and it, you can't see through the floor.
Those cars are garbage. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you're so what are we building this for? Lemons, potentially, or just to have a Plymouth Sapporo around that you'll eventually cut into pieces and haul off to the scrapyard when your plans change.
We're gonna like, the Jordan special.
This is gonna go to your house.
Fuck it is. Have you seen my house? I've almost got it cleaned up. I can walk in my garage again.
Dodge made a delightful turbo four cylinder.
They did.
That we would just find a way to put into that. Oh. And then you have 200 plus horsepower and all the torques to completely obliterate that 5 3/4 inch rear end.
And then all you need is a horn that goes meep meep and a vinyl. Somebody here in this around this table makes stickers now.
Yeah. Ooh, and we can make a cardboard nose that's pointy. And it'll have little like flaps with cables so you can like see the headlights, but they won't, they'll still be like 2 feet back, so they won't do anything.
I regret having gone down this path. Now we're too far in.
Oh, come on. Yeah. What, do you have anything else, or should we?
I mean, there's the rest of it. I mean, there's the
he's got one sentence on his notepad.
The rest of it.
The rest of it.
Yeah, it says these guys are assholes. Like, I like foretold things. Like you was like, pause for ridicule.
One to know one.
I was not ridiculing you. I was thinking how it would be hilarious if in our revisionist history they came full circle and there was an Omni that was, now if there was, we know it would have been the GLH in reality, but if there was an Omni that was a huge flop, they're like, we're going to bring back the GTO. If it was a Pontiac, or we're going to bring, I mean, it could have been any of these and they've done it, you know, the others have done it too. Like the Nova that was a Prism
Corolla.
Yes. Yeah. Built. Yeah.
Great car. Not a Nova.
Right. I was like, well, you missed the mark there.
Yeah. As far as racing goes, I mean, we've already talked, it was legislated out of existence by NASCAR, a lot of drag cars built out of these.
Yeah.
They were a big race car. Hot Wheels makes several.
I have not made surprised. Several. They're certainly one of the most striking cars of the era. The wing cars.
The fuselage. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
The fuselage cars are interesting too, compared to compatriots as well, but like. I know I have seen half a dozen of the Daytona and Superbird. Like
there's nothing else like them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you're like, even non-car people are like, what the hell is that?
And that's why they didn't sell, is because you didn't want to be that guy at the grocery
pretty
store.
Pretty much. Yeah.
You roll up with your open headers and
yeah. That's what I got. Would we buy it? I mean,
what do you think, Jordan? Would you buy one?
If I was considering something of the period, this would certainly be of interest because, I don't know, a lot of the Chevy stuff I'm interested in is kind of priced me out. Ford is hit or miss on whether or not it speaks to me. Like the 71, 72 that's a good looking car. Mm-hmm. And if you're just trying to, build something that is a fun cruiser that makes cool V8 noises, it's a pretty solid option.
And you could buy it. You can find the satellite version cheaper, and they are cosmetically the same.
I mean,
it's different. you know, if you're going to have to fix it up and paint it anyway, then you're not losing anything by starting with a satellite if you're going to build a driver.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I don't. So was the satellite a higher trim package? Because the Roadrunner was always supposed to be the.
It got a little muddied in the 70s, and it's, you know, the Roadrunner started cheap, mm-hmm. but you could option it up as far as you wanted to go, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they folded the GTX in like 71 or 72. So the GTX became the fancy Roadrunner. Mm. So the satellite was just the more pedestrian Roadrunner, mm-hmm. Just the slow version. And then the sport satellite was the the higher version, essentially.
So if you had a satellite that was a roller, there's not a whole lot of difference with a Roadrunner.
My uncle, about 15 years ago, found a 69 sport satellite convertible, and he specifically wanted a B-body ragtop. And this thing was as far gone as it could be. I helped him drag it home from Jefferson City to Sedalia, and it is now a 440 six-pack, four-speed, like a Roadrunner in everything but name. Mm-hmm. But he likes it because you see Roadrunners at shows. You don't see satellites or sports satellites unless people have built them into a Roadrunner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about that with the Buick Regal T-Type Grand National.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'd be excited about a T-Type.
I would.
Because.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'd also be excited to have it in a color other than black. That was the thing. The Grand National looks badass, but. Yeah. That's kind of boring, you know?
Also, like a Regal with a 455 and a 5-speed or 6-speed in it. That'd be fun, too. But that's a Regal, not a...
We're not talking about Buicks today.
And
it's that other company that your mind doesn't really have a capability of hold on to.
That's right.
Fly mouth?
Yeah. I think Alan's answer is, I don't need to buy one of these. There's one already.
I will inherit one if I don't just steal it piece by piece
at some point. One of the other is your plan there, right?
Yes. Yeah. Eventually, I will have a Roadrunner project.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked to my dad about it. I'm probably buying it off him at some point. Yeah. You know, when
it makes sense.
Yeah, you should ask him if he'll do installments. Because then it's just sort of like you're just counting against inheritance.
Well, I'm actually already buying, talk to him about buying it piece by piece because I'm like, hey, can I buy a big block off you for the duster? Yeah. Can I buy that, you know, 355 Sure Grip center chunk you got? Yeah. Like not everything fits on a duster, but the stuff that does, I'm already like, you're not using it. No.
You know, the old parable about how you trap a pig? It's like a wild pig. Throw some corn on the ground and the pig comes and eats it. And then next day you throw some corn on the ground and put one panel of a fence next to it. And then, you know, you over the days and then you put a gate on it, but leave it open and throw some corn in. And the last day you just come and you close the gate. This is how Alan is going to own a Plymouth Roadrunner. Is going to be like, hey, Dad, can I buy a big block for my duster? Yeah, sure, sure. Hey, Dad, can I buy this part for the – Oh, wait. Actually, can I buy this part? And hey, wait. It just makes sense to build a Roadrunner now. Can I just buy a couple more pieces?
Well, the way – so it's worth telling the story about how my dad wound up with this. So he had a 69 Roadrunner in college when he was – so this would have been like 1977, 78. Mm-hmm. When he met my mom, he took her home from their first date in this car. And so it always had special – and it was also the fastest thing he'd ever owned. And he would always tell me stories about how fast it was. So he sold it in 1979, 79 to 80, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was not nice. Right. It was fast, but it was ratty. And it drove some of his friends with nicer cars nuts that he was faster and it looked like shit. So, and it was also very stock. It was a 383 four speed with headers, as he would say, a headers and a chrome air cleaner. And other than that, they had never touched it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you said it was a 69, right?
Yeah.
So it had a real four barrel on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was 10.5-to-1 compression, you know, 335 horsepower.
Yeah.
I don't know what it had for gears, but it was quick. He sold it and in 1990, and he knew where it wound up because it actually wound up in the ownership of our local garbage man who cannibalized it for parts for his Roadrunner. Mm-hmm. So it was down to just a unibody. And I remember when I was 8, my dad took me out on this country road. He's like, you see that car? And I'm like, is that a car? And he's like, shut up, boy. but he told me the story. He's like, someday I'm going to fix that car up. And then, you know, period, nothing happened. And when I was 13, so this would have been 1995, My mom knew where it was and decided, okay, here's what we're going to do. Talk to our neighbor, who's also a gearhead and a body man, and convinced him to tell my dad he needed help doing something like going to pick up a car or something a couple towns over. And, oh God, I'm trying to remember. No, he had his cousin take my dad on the pretense, and our neighbor helped us drag this thing home. And I mean, it was literally like a stripped unibody. Like our neighbor came up with the rear end and rollers, and we dragged it onto a trailer and shoved it into the garage. And this was Father's Day. Mm-hmm. And, my dad comes home and we're all sitting in the yard in lawn chairs, like just around the garage, like looking down at the garage. And he's like, "What's going on?" We're like, "Nothing." He's like, "Okay, I need to go get," it was like his cousin had told me he needed a tool or something. Right. So he walks into the garage and literally trips over it. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Whoa, what? Yeah. So no idea.
Surprise, yeah.
No idea.
So wow. This is the same unibody.
Yes. Wow. Stripped of everything. And he bought like four or five different parts cars, stripped the parts down for him, hung one new quarter panel on it, put the trunk lid in it, and then or trunk floor in it, and then just kind of lost steam about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
So at some point, you know, he's talked about getting going on it again, but I mean, I don't know. Yeah. You know, if he will or not. It's kind of the way I talk about projects. I mean, you've seen me. It's hereditary.
We all have that occasionally.
Yep.
I agree.
This is going to be hell to edit, isn't it? It's just me and long-winded stories.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to be that bad at all.
Every third episode's exactly like that, so he's used to it by now.
No, I don't think so. We did all right.
So my thought from earlier, where Chevy came in, and you're going to have to help me out here as far as time period. Because I think the Charger had been out for a few years, 2007 or 8, right? The new Charger?
05.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The SS was?
13.
Yeah. Substantially later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, so the Charger was Dodge's midsize or whatever they want to call that particular market segment. And the SS is a little bit bigger. But the SS came out and had no options. It was
you want it?
$45,000, yeah. And I think your choices were manual or automatic.
Uh-huh. And I think you had to pay more for the manual, too.
Well, I understand that. Whereas the Charger, you could get, you know, I don't even know what – Charger's never had a manual, has it?
Nah, this version of the Charger has never gotten a manual.
Yeah. The old ones, of course, but the 05 Plus. Right. But you could go to the Dodge dealership and say – I want a V8 rear-wheel drive sedan to haul my family around with. $30,000, mm-hmm. whatever it was. Whereas Chevy was like, oh, your choices are you can either buy a Camaro, mm-hmm. which has no backseat,
right.
or you can give us nearly $50,000 for this. It's a decent-looking car, but it's still...
It's anonymous.
It's anonymous.
Not bad-looking, but it's just kind of...
Yeah, it looks there. A bit like a Malibu and just bigger.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's $50,000.
Yeah. So it's not quite an apples to apples comparison there, because the SS was like 430 horse, 450.
Yeah.
So you had to step up to the Scat Pack Charger, but you're still undercutting the SS by about $10,000.
Yeah.
And you're getting something that's more extroverted in terms of looks and personality.
Yeah.
And whether that's a plus or not is up for debate. I've always said the only thing keeping me from buying a Scat Pack Charger is other Scat Pack Charger owners and people immediately assuming I'm a fucking dirtbag because I'm driving this loud ass car.
Well, you got to get a purple one with stripes so they can really have that opinion cemented. Well, it's just funny that, you know, we were discussing that mm-hmm. earlier with the Roadrunner and that its success over some of the GM's offerings. And it's like, oh, I've seen this before.
It
because
is. Yeah.
They were the only two people occupying the American V8 rear-wheel drive market those years.
Yeah. Sedans. Yeah.
I mean,
you could buy a Mustang.
But yeah. No, I definitely meant sedans. Yeah. Realistic people movers.
Yeah.
Because modern pony cars have no backseats.
Except the Challenger.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
No, it does.
It will hold two adults. It's a pain in the ass to get back there, but yeah. I have road tripped in a Challenger and it is not bad.
Being yeah. Okay. But it's
800 pounds heavier than a Mustang or a Camaro too.
Right. And frankly, at that point, I would just rather have a Charger because it has real doors. And aside from the availability of a manual,
that's your big one.
Yeah. That's like the only thing that is preferable on. Yeah.
Anyway. I don't understand why they never put a manual in a Charger. And we kind of talked about this. I don't know if it was space in the tunnel or.
Yeah.
Or if they just didn't think they'd sell any of them, because I think that would be.
Well, it doesn't necessarily make sense that it would be space in the tunnel because the Charger and the Challenger are built on the same platform, right?
Ish. Oh, yes. Yes, they are.
The Challenger's obviously a modification.
Yeah.
But I didn't. Usually those modifications don't go so far as things like pan dimensions.
And technically, I think they're if you want to get real technical, they share a lot of common DNA with like an early aughts E-Class.
Yeah.
Like that was the DNA.
Yeah.
Which is honestly a pretty good car because they're still selling it 20 years later, you know. Right.
And the downfall of that particular car was the biodegradable wiring harness.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything that Dodge used. Those are the ones to avoid, Alex.
Yeah, the Mercedes's that are starting to get cheap enough that they're visible to you.
Yeah,
you don't want them.
That's we've been through this a time or two on our text chats. Hey, is this the one with the? Yes, don't buy. Is this the one with the biodegradable wiring harness? Yes, Alex, you don't want it. Okay,
I think that's all most I of those have removed themselves from the road by now, probably. Or have been had their.
Yeah, there was a big warranty. I don't think it was a recall exactly, but Mercedes was like, we'll replace the wiring harness if you really feel it's necessary, you know. Mm-hmm. Mercedes dealers sound like in my head, but yeah.
I suppose we could do that.
He thinks it's the Rolls-Royce dealership, I feel like.
It's time for
Rolls-Royce doesn't have dealerships. Co-host. You write expressing interest to the factory, and they're like, we'll send a steamship post-haste.
A man just shows up at your house with, a leather-bound booklet of options and color swatches.
No, he just shows up with the car, and he's like, you wanted a Rolls-Royce. Here's your Rolls-Royce. Here's your bill. Yeah. Rolls-Royce's marketing until, the mid-aughts was, how many horsepower does this engine make? And they would just say, sufficient.
Yeah.
They wouldn't tell you how much power it was. It's like, it's enough.
Well, and they wouldn't use I think they still, is it Rolls-Royce? They don't use a tack. They use a percentage of power available gauge. So if you floor it, it goes to zero because you're using all of it. Power. Yeah.
That can't be true.
It is. I'm pretty certain it's Rolls-Royce because Bentley actually wants you to drive their cars.
Bentley is like Rolls-Royce's less autistic cousin. it's a good car. Just trust us that you.
It's really Lamborghini and Ferrari if they were British, because Ferrari is the very specific thing that they want to do, and this and this, and Lamborghini's woo, burnouts, and that's the luxury car British equivalent. Mm.
Mm. Mm. Yes, quite.
I mean, Bentley literally in the 90s or late 80s, I don't know, made a car that was the Turbo R. Like, that doesn't sound like something that you want to sell to people who have to wear shirts with starch and have actual arguments about what style of leather shoe you should wear with your suit. That's
not. I feel attacked.
Do you argue about?
I occasionally iron my shirt.
No. Always have to have starch is what I was getting at.
I mean, if I'm wearing it under a suit, usually, yes.
Welcome to Junk Connoisseurs, where 33.33, repeating, of course, percent of your host occasionally iron a shirt.
I occasionally iron a shirt.
I had occasion to recently.
I'm thinking of, oddly enough... Mm. A Simpsons quote where Mr. Burns gets off to after what's his face for ironing a crease into his jeans.
Smithers. No, sir. Smithers. Thank you. Those creases are in your legs.
Thank you.
So they are.
Yes, exactly.
Well, do we have any shout outs or callbacks? Anybody contact us this week? And
I got shout backs and call outs.
Yeah?
No.
I mean, I would have to go look at Facebook. We had a couple.
Did anybody go do their homework and listen to Chuck Berry's Jaguar and Thunderbird? Or maybe it's Thunderbird and Jaguar.
No.
A CW McCall 8-track stuck in my tape deck since you...
I didn't know you got me on
Black Bear Pass like 8 years ago.
There's a good one there. Well, you need to listen to it. And I tried to get you to listen to it, well, all of you, a while back because you had a running Jaguar for about...
13 hours.
Okay. 6 minutes.
It ran long enough to get back in the garage and start being disassembled.
And I have a running Thunderbird. It's like, oh, too bad you're cutting it up, or we could recreate the Jaguar and Thunderbird song by Chuck Berry. So, yeah, listen to that if you haven't.
Just need to tell Robbie to drive his Jag down here, and then you can do that.
There you go. Yeah. We'll do it. That'll be great. We just got to find a Newtonville somewhere between here and there. That's the subject town in the song.
I think I looked it up, and the closest one is Tennessee.
Yeah.
Listen, so everybody needs a road trip.
Might have to play it for you. I'll come up with... I know I'm not the mic. I'll cut this out.
Yeah, don't play it on air, because then we're going to get DMCA'd.
DMCA.
Music.
Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Oh.
Basically, it's everybody being like, you can't play that music on the radio.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, fair use. And they'll be like, our lawyers are better than your lawyers. And I'll be like, no argument here. We'll take it down.
Yeah. Well, I have another homework song for you and for our listeners. You've talked about C.W. McCall tonight. You've mentioned that. It's not by C.W. McCall. It's by the other type of music I listen to, which is Jan and Dean. A lot of you already probably know this, but Dead Man's Curve.
Okay, I've actually heard that song. Oh, you came up with some Jan and Dean song that I'm like, what the actual fuck is this? But
that's
yes,
our
collaboration. I've heard Dead Man's Curve.
Yeah, a lot of people have. Yeah. But if you haven't, listen to it. And so both of these songs that I've mentioned this episode and the last are what I'd call like automotive storyline songs where they have a fun, not always fun. They have a story throughout the song. So
better or worse than Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen singing Hot Rod Lincoln?
That is a great song. So I don't know how to answer that. That's also on the list.
Do you like it more or less than?
I'd say I like the Jan and Dean one slightly less, but I've known it longer. So
I don't know. They lost me. They lost me on Hot Rod Lincoln when it was like shifted down into overdrive, and I'm like, that's not how it works. Just bugs me.
I shoved it on down into overdrive. Well, I mean, if you're up, down, I don't know.
Maybe probably he has a reverse actuated shifter. So 1, 2, 3, 4.
He's racing a Model A.
Yeah.
Against a Model A. So, I mean, this was like 1962. I'm not sure reverse manual pattern valve. Nothing had overdrive in 1962.
If that's the biggest gripe you have about that song, that's I'm just going to say, get over it. So, I don't have anything else tonight either, unless you two do. The only thing left to say is, stay fresh, cheese bags.
But yeah, this was the cheap way to get a Hemi.
Yeah.
It would get yanked and put in a, you know, an E-body or something else.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Burped through the podcast.
Surprise.